Masuria, Poland. Quiet lakes. Moss. A road that looks like an escape route and drags you into a room where people planned murder on a scale we pretend to understand. The wolf's lair sits in the reeds and trees like a bad idea that learned architecture. It was built fast with forced labor, concrete walls 6 meters thick, camouflage that tried to make barbarism look like a nature walk. 50 bunkers, 70 barracks, 2 airfields, a railway stop, a tea house, a casino, a cinema, and more landmines than anyone bothered counting after lunch. It was a weekend spa for people who issued orders that turned into graves. Hitler used it as a living room and a war room. He spent about 800 days here. He read the press, ate breakfast, spent an hour with his dog, and signed decisions that killed millions. The image of a man walking a shepherd in a swamp while whole nations burned is the sort of thing you wish was a metaphor but isn't. One room, now only a pile of stones, is where a man planted a briefcase bomb at 12:42 p.m. on July 20, 1944. The explosion killed 3 people, failed to stop the machine, and led to 5,000 executions. The attempt did not clean the slate. It only made the castle more cautious and the guards more certain. When the Red Army came, retreating Germans blew what they could. The blasts left many ruins stubbornly intact, proving both the thoroughness and the waste. After the war, the site rotted. After communism, it became an open-air museum. After memory, it became a market. The Polish state fixed it up. Visitors now flow through numbered paths, read tidy information boards, and take pictures of stalactites in Hitler's command post. In 2024, a hotel and restaurant opened. You can eat pierogi next to the place orders for mass murder were discussed, and feel cultural tourism do its work, soothe the discomfort with dumplings. Tourism and preservation here wear the same suit. They clean the place so visitors can feel respectable while looking at the bones of organized cruelty. Some people worry that polishing a site of atrocity invites the wrong kind of pilgrimage. Others count visitors and rename the experience learning. American companies will make a film. Someone will license postcards. We will measure everything in attendance and amenity. The forest keeps doing what forests do, growing through bunkers, lifting trees out of concrete like nature is both patient and insulted. Moss buries a bunker the size of a small country. Stagnant ponds mirror cracked walls and the sky that watched it. The place is both a ruin and a showroom. The Wolf's Lair is a museum of choices and their consequences. It also shows what we do with those consequences. Catalog them, tour them, monetize them, argue over plaques while the trees get on with reclaiming what we tried to hold. History stays messy. People tidy it up and sell tickets. We keep walking by, looking at numbered stones and calling it remembrance.
Remember when your biggest problem was the Wi-Fi dropping during your show's season finale? Cute. Meet the new plot twist. A 31-year-old chemical engineer at Georgia Tech, 2 toddlers in tow, an 18-year-old car that gave up in the cold, and 9 years of college stretched into survival mode. Because losing financial aid and a flat tire are apparently a greater threat to higher education than thermodynamics, this is not the kind of story that fits into a sponsored Instagram carousel about radical self-care. It's the kind of story that gets saved by strangers who don't retweet a hashtag and move on. They actually buy groceries, mail rent checks, and drive steel-toed boots to somebody who needs them to go to work. The nonprofit's Facebook post reads like one of those reality shows where someone wins a makeover, except the makeover is don't be homeless. And the prize is a tank of gas. Meanwhile, in the first world, we're inventing crises that would confuse a functioning social safety net. Outraged that our coffee was poured with almond milk instead of oat, existential dread because an app's UX was redesigned, and trauma over a 3-minute shipping delay. We'll spend $12 on a drink that tastes like a lawn ornament, and then scoff when a stranger asks for $30 to keep a family from being evicted. If $30 is the price of your brunch, maybe your brunch shouldn't be a recurring event, and someone's rent should be. The clever part of this new charity model is its economy of specificity. Donors aren't feeding nameless bureaucracies. They're learning a mom's name, seeing a kid's drawing, and getting an Instacart receipt that says, milk, eggs, hope. That is social media doing something other than amplifying outrage and selling you a mattress that fixes your back and your very being. There's an irony here that tastes like cheap coffee. People cancel subscriptions because the economy's tight, while others who can barely get by pinch pennies and still sponsor a family. It's like watching 2 seasons of capitalism in one afternoon, one where people complain about battery life on their wireless earbuds, and another where a vetted check for back rent prevents a family from becoming a statistic. If there's a moral, it isn't saccharine. It's logistical. $30 buys groceries. $40 can get someone boots to go to work. A weekly grocery delivery can change a toddler's diet from convenience store cereal to actual vegetables. And behavior improves the way math gets better after sleep, gradually and decisively. The absurdity is that our culture treats micro-inconveniences like tragedies, while actual crises get crowdfunding blurbs and thank you notes. You download an app to track your steps. Someone else tracks whether a kid eats dinner tonight. So next time your rideshare is 5 minutes late and you're composing an epic about ruined plans, remember that first world problem used to mean out of almond milk. Now it's a reminder that complaining about minor discomforts is a privilege. Spend the cost of your moral outrage on something practical. Sponsor a family. Buy groceries. Or, if you must keep your principles intact, at least stop calling it trauma when your phone dies. Real trauma has a mailing address.
A winter storm turned the Northeast into a public systems audit and a gallery of small failures. Airports blinked red on the screens as if they were sending a polite, color-coded warning about how thin the wires holding everything together have become. About 8,700 flights were delayed and almost 1,000 canceled on Saturday, adding to Friday's thousands of disruptions. JFK, LaGuardia, and Newark shuffled schedules like tired puppeteers. Boston added its own stuttering choreography. Travelers waited, bundled and patient, obeying the new civic etiquette. Accept inconvenience with a resigned smile. People posed beneath Christmas trees and cleared sidewalks, treating chaos as another seasonal chore. The busiest travel day of the holidays still loomed, nearly 2.86 million expected, because routine migration is sacred, even when the system hiccups hard enough to spill baggage across. Terminals. Cities lit up their winter rituals. Crews salted. Plows lurched into motion. Snowblowers hummed. A choreography of patchwork resilience. Central Park got just over 4 inches of snow. Westchester saw up to 6. Connecticut topped 8. And remote Hartwick reported more than 11. Michigan's trees and lines sagged under ice, leaving more than 30,000 homes and businesses in the dark. A few hundred thousand people without power. And the public calendar still read, work, travel, celebrate. The forecast is an honest promise of escalation. Another storm on Sunday. Blizzard warnings for the upper Midwest and Great Lakes with potential foot plus totals, then bitter cold. Freezing rain will coat the Appalachians. A tenth of an inch of ice is expected in many places. Lake effect snows will pick a few neighborhoods and punish them repeatedly. This is not an anomaly, it's a live demonstration of how brittle infrastructure meets predictable weather and how normal life keeps grinding forward while the seams widen. Systems delayed, flights canceled, lights out, plows out, repeat performance scheduled. The machinery that keeps modern life moving is proving dramatic in its capacity to stagger under old threats. And we applaud each small recovery like it's proof everything will hold.
The existential crisis hour. Based on CNN's article, Brain Rot, you open your phone and meet a stranger's perfect vacation before you've tied your shoes. A scroll later, someone lives off-grid like that's a personality trait. Another swipe and a CEO promises your hustle will be optimized by an algorithm that has better job security than you. If your brain had a refrigerator light, it would be flickering. Brain rot is the charming name we give this slow cultural decline. It isn't a medical diagnosis. It is a complaint, a meme, and a confession all at once. It means your attention is being rented out in 15-second chunks to content that makes you laugh and forget why you existed 5 minutes ago. The mechanics are honest in their cruelty. Tiny dopamine jackpots designed to keep fingers moving. Short videos are the sugar cereal of attention. They taste great. They leave you jittery, and you start expecting every experience to come with confetti and a baseline of exhilaration. Long books, real conversations, paying bills. Suddenly, they're all advertised like low-energy tasks. Worse for the kids, the article warns. Children need messy, slow practice at being humans, facial cues, playground grief, the baffling rules of friendship. If their formative hours are ceded to rapid-fire content, their developing brains get fewer practice runs at patience, empathy, boredom, which is to say, they might grow up fluent in memes but poor in nuance. But it's not only a pediatric problem. Adults model the tiny rituals we wish we'd deny, reaching for a screen while driving at dinner, during a lull. That behavior is a map we hand to the next generation with invisible ink, saying don't while doing it yourself is the performance art of failed parenting. Science is cautious, but the hints are bleakly plausible. The same circuits that light up for addiction respond to endless scrolling. Attention control frays when it's practiced in bursts and never in stretches. You can call it brain rot, mental mush, or just modern leisure. The result looks the same on the calendar. Hours erased. Solutions in the article are practical and slightly depressing. Don't rely on willpower, rearrange the environment. Delete the app and visit the platform through a browser. Schedule your doom scrolling like a sensible vice. A fixed slot before something important so you can't accidentally watch 6 hours of someone opening packages. Put friction between you and the infinite. There's a humane note. Mindless leisure is not an unforgivable sin. Every generation has wasted time differently. If your life functions, you work, sleep, love. Pay taxes. A little Gilligan's Island in your history is allowable. The problem is when the leisure becomes the life. The irony is that we built tools to make life easier and ended up giving our attention away free to entities optimized to keep it. We wanted connection and productivity. We received a playlist of tiny, thrilling distractions and a slow erosion of our ability to sit with boredom, with thought, with meaning. So what's the existential move? It's not dramatic renunciation. It's small architecture. Change the environment, model restraint, and choose deeper engagements occasionally. Read a paragraph that resists reward, listen to someone who doesn't perform, let boredom ring like an empty bell until it means something again. If the human project feels absurd, the way we craft lives and then surrender them to an algorithm, at least we can be honest about it. We can laugh and admit our screen time is a ridiculous ritual. We can set limits. We can teach children that being human isn't a highlight reel. And if none of that works, there is always the browser. It asks for an extra click before it swallows your afternoon. It's almost philosophical in its small stubbornness.
They flattened the economy to save it and ended up rigging it for people who already own things. Low rates during the pandemic didn't just stabilize commerce, they turned mortgages into time machines. Roughly a fifth of homeowners are still sitting on SUV 3% mortgages, watching their homes inflate in value while their monthly bills barely move. That edge is generational wealth dressed up as a pandemic perk. Meanwhile, the stock market keeps climbing, fed by slick bets on AI and glossy corporate profits. A 3-year bull run is cheered as national success, even though it mostly pads brokerage accounts at the top of the income ladder. The same policy that drove asset prices skyward left renters and wage earners stuck paying rising rents and grocery bills. If you don't own a house or a portfolio, the recovery looked like someone else's party. This K-shaped split isn't a fluke. It's the logical output of decades of liquidity injections that favor assets over wages. After 2008, the machine was recalibrated to reward financial claims. When you flood markets with cheap money, prices of homes and stocks, the primary stores of American wealth, inflate. The pandemic measures accelerated that trend. The winners were those who could borrow, invest, or simply already own. The Federal Reserve, now admitting it can't effectively target inequality, points to jobs and wage growth as their remedy. That's a convenient limitation. Their hammer is blunt. Cutting and raising short-term rates nudges borrowing costs, but it doesn't put a house in a renter's name or a stock grant in a cashier's account. Long-term yields, asset prices, the distribution of home loans, those are shaped by structural forces the Fed can't micromanage without throwing the whole show into chaos. Politicians perform concern. President Trump downplayed affordability, even as it climbed the list of voter anxieties. The script is predictable. Promise broad prosperity, while the policy toolkit funnels gains to asset holders. Companies pour cash into AI projects and share buybacks, not sweatshop to street reform. The economy hums on corporate earnings and headline GDP, while affordability erodes for most people. This isn't an isolated failure. Every detail. SUB 3% mortgages, surging stock indices, wage gaps that favor the wealthy, is a symptom of a system that monetizes safety nets and privatizes gains. The fever dream of capitalism is simple. Turn public crisis response into private profit and call it stability. Until politics confronts who actually benefits from policy, the divide will keep widening and the American promise will keep shrinking.